So this is talking with Professor Henk Vanderhals in Leiden on 26 November 73.
Where's your microphone?
Built in.
Built in, okay.
It's a Philips.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I guess we should go back to the colloquium, of course. And what was the situation? I mean, how did you come to do a colloquium in radio astronomy? During the war.
Well, in the years previous to the war, I had first started to study mathematics as a main subject, and then physics. But it became soon clear to me that lots of interesting things were going on in astronomy, and so I had not quite decided whether astronomy would be my main subject, but those were grim years, and Professor Minnaert, who was my main professor in Utrecht, was in a hostage camp, and there was for us still some possibility to get around, and so an arrangement was made that I could spend a number of months at Leiden Observatory, which was, however, closed. The entire university was closed.
Right.
Or it was not there. It would be too dangerous for him to actually be there, but he came occasionally, and so, and even occasionally gave some lectures in a dark room. So
Dark room?
Yeah, in a dark room, yes. So, yeah, that was that Hedgeprom wouldn't know, because Hedgeprom, as a foreigner and not a very politically versed person,
I see,
was somewhat of an unreliable chain in the link in the total chain. So,
when did this start? When
they left him out. Oh, that.
When was the university closed and all this trouble started?
I should know the exact year, but I bet it was already 1940 that the actual university was closed. Yeah.
And that's when the journals from the outside stopped and so forth also?
No, that went on a little longer via different routes. Some came via Portugal and some via different routes, via Sweden, I think. So, but after a few years that also stopped.
Yeah. Okay, well, I interrupted you.
Any,
you were really at Utrecht, and you came.
Anyhow, I was at Utrecht, yeah, but Minnaert was in a hostage camp, and it finally boiled down to really self-service, and we had a library available there, so I read many different things. And when I came here, I came especially to get some acquaintance of work going on here and get some further contacts with Oort. And he then suggested that this would be a brand new and very important topic to be discussed at one of our Astronomer Club meetings. And he suggested that I might be the good person to read up on the subject and to give a review of that.
And he was basing this only on Reber's work, or did he know about Jansky's? Well, of course, Reber.
Reber quoted Jansky's, right. But he knew only Reber's work. Yeah.
He hadn't seen the actual Jansky papers.
No,
yeah.
No. Well, it takes some people with a really a fine nose to see when something is important.
Right.
And Oort is one of those persons who has that property.
And so he just decided to organize a colloquium on this new subject.
Yeah.
And.
And so I spent, I think, those months mostly doing that, reading and reading up everything about the Gaunt factor and all kinds of. I had done work on, of course, in astrophysics before and on interstellar matter. It was somewhat familiar to me, but this particular thing was quite new to me.
Yeah, free transitions.
Yeah.
And what was. What sort of, were you given a completely free hand as to what to do, or did?
Yes, okay. In principle, it was to tell what was in the paper of Reber first of all, and then Henyi and Kinan, I think. Yeah.
Right. But yeah. Then you expanded a good bit.
And of course, you try, whenever you do something, you try to expand. And so I try to do the. Well, if I remember, I try to do the continuum work a bit more precisely. Went in detail into the Menzel Pekaris paper on the God factors, right. And so on. And I I also did something which I felt at the time was rather important, and which I could have followed up later, but I didn't. But at the time, there were a number of people who made remarks that the population of the different levels could be different from a Boltzmann distribution, and that only a small difference in that population would be sufficient to completely overthrow the normal factor H nu over KT when you reduce from actual absorption to effective absorption.
So it tracks the induced emission.
And that was quite well known, and I convinced myself, and that is in my paper.
Yeah, you have a little note to that.
In the particular case of the continuum spectrum, you can actually prove that there is no worry at all, because you can differently rearrange so that you compensate not a transition by the exactly opposite transition, but by up and down from the same level. And in fact, I found later out that if you do the same thing for a harmonic oscillator, that gives a very nice illustration of the transition from the classical, from the quantum mechanical approach to the classical approach. So, but when I say, I think that was entirely convincing. I think the best answer to that question, which was given at the time, but of course, what I should have added there is that if at some future time a line is found in the radio spectrum, then the warning sign is fully up again, because then this trick does not work, and then you have all the possibility to have something like a maser.
Right.
But that particular step I did not take.
And that would have been a very nice prediction also.
But it's absolutely clear that it's there, you see.
But your results did agree, even though you did things a bit more carefully, very
is it,
exactly
course,
the same.
Agreed quite well, yeah. And, I also at that time, of course, looked whether the individual alpha lines would be observable. And I applied the English Stellar broadening formula, and probably I made an error or they made an error in that earlier paper. Anyhow, I came out with the conclusion that the lines were there, but they would be too strongly broadened to make them observable. And that, of course, was proven wrong
in 64,
nearly 20 years later. Yeah,
I think they made the error. I have their paper. I haven't checked it, but... I think they vastly overestimate the stark broadening. But I want to talk to you a little bit later about that.
Yeah.
I've done some calculations.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, that was too bad that came out that way. Also, that would have been another very nice prediction.
I'm not sure about it now, but from this note I wrote to Moffat in 1965, I have the impression that at that time I have gone over my old notes and found that I made a substitution error. And... if you have time, you can go. The notes are still there. You can see if there is a substitution error there. But it's a lot of work. I never get around to it. It's not even pleasant one way or the other to find it. It's,
right.
Yeah.
I haven't actually checked if Inglis and Teller overestimate that much or not.
Yeah. So, and then, of course, I I systematically went from the continuum through the bound from free to free bound to the bound normal lines, and then to the fine structure lines, and then to the hyperfine structure line, and that last one I came to a tentative conclusion that there was a fair chance, although I didn't believe it myself, as you remarked myself, right. From the wording, I was really overcautious, perhaps.
But this was had not been measured at all, this line. It was only a theoretical prediction.
It was at that time, that I remember very well, because I was here, and actually it was linking two things together. Calculating the frequency, which was nowhere in the literature as far as I know, was very simple. You had to find some paper of Fermi where generally it gave the splitting. Mm-hmm. And then I looked in the book of Kupfermann Kernmomente, where they had measured the magnetic moment of the proton. And those two things together did it. And so my matter of just one substitution.
They gave you the dipole moment, essentially.
To get the frequency was just a matter of one substitution of a number of one book into a formula of another book. And in order to get the transition probability, of course I went to Conan and Shortley and tried to find what kind of magnetic strength would be necessary to do it, and I found that seemed not an unreasonable number. I also found a transition probability, which would be expressed in inverse time, would correspond to an enormously long time scale. But this is all so far outside the normal experience of that I felt, well, something else might be wrong, nobody can tell. I talked to a number of good theoretical physicists who were all somewhat cautious on their predictions, and that's why I worded my text rather cautiously.
Like you say, there had been a little bit of microwave spectroscopy done by that time, but very little.
But certainly not that I knew of.
But I don't think any for that line. No. Yeah, only ammonia, I think, was the first that was done. So, you worked for 6 months preparing this, and then this colloquium...
Well, I don't know if it's 6 months. Of course, I went... at that time, we could still travel. It was 43, I traveled back and forth from Leiden 3 or 4 times for a certain stretch here.
But most of the work was done here?
Almost exclusively here, right. Leiden. And I know at one time also Oort stopping off at my house in Leiden because he was on his bicycle on his way to in my house in Utrecht, which was about halfway the place where he was living in the country.
I see.
And Leiden, about 100 kilometers tour, and he stopped off halfway in order to fix a flat tire, and we discussed some more about interstellar matter. So this is typical for that time.
Right. Often did he cycle this back in?
Oh, I don't know. He never publicized what he actually did, because certainly the official person should not know where he was.
Right. But he frequently came up here and gave lectures. Right. Well, what about this colloquium itself? It was given here in Leiden.
Yeah.
And that was in June 44, is that?
I would have to look up the date.
I think it says on there.
June 44.
But can you tell me, was this part of a series of colloquia? Was this some special thing?
Yes, we had... it's nice that you asked that, because it really gives the background of the years before the war. You must realize that certainly at that time there was already quite a boost in astronomy and astrophysics in the Netherlands, and of course Kaptein I have never known, that is long before my time, but his school in Groningen was still quite growing strong. There was the Utrecht school of Minard, who had more or less just started, but had after building forth on a longer tradition in solar physics.
Yeah.
And then there was the school of Pannekoek in Amsterdam, Pannekoek was completely a self-made man, but he had all the astrophysics in on his fingertips and had written a magnificent standard paper in the Handbuch der Astrophysik on stellar atmospheres and ionization equation. And so there was at one time, so the axis from Utrecht to Amsterdam with many discussions about stellar atmospheres, and from Groningen to Leiden with many discussions about, say, stellar statistics, and the structure of the galaxy, and so on. And of course, Leiden was this Hertzsprung, and the Sitter has had the biggest name abroad, but all these others counted strongly. And so there was a rather lively group of people wishing to get together to discuss the newest literature and to have this, what they call an inter-university symposium, which, in fact,
especially during the war,
because the initial format was that the Astronomen Club, which has as its members many people who have studied astronomy a long time ago and now teaching in intermediate level. So that must be a bit popular to have that afternoon session with a somewhat more general lecture, and to fill the morning with a much heavier advanced seminar on certain topics. I remember, Pannekoek could just stand for the blackboard and go on for 2.5 hours writing formulae and explaining them. So in that context, we had also this inter-university colloquium on radio astronomy.
I see. But did these begin before the war, actually? Or?
No. So this started in the earlier war years. You see, there was, of course, like always, when the literature falls down, you get a tendency to do more things among yourselves, and that was what happened.
So you're basically trying to pool your knowledge, in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, these others, are they published also?
Yes, there are a number of them published. There are, I think the first one was about the particle and non-thermal emission from the sun, which of course in 1940 was a very, very new subject. And then there's one about planetary and gaseous nebulae, where I have also taken a certain part in the preparation.
But these are in the Nederlandse tijdschrift?
These are all in that, yes. There are some which are perhaps less successful. There is. And there are still later ones.
Yeah, I know the later ones.
Well, I think you like to see those. I have. I must have a collection of the early ones.
Yes. Well, after we're finished, I'd like to see them.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll. Let's not forget it. That I'll try to find them.
So this was given, and well, I know another question is, who is this Bakker that gave the other half?
Well, of course, you want to bring in real experts. And Bakker at that time was was a man at the Philips research laboratory who knew all about electronics and antennae. But he later became the physics professor in Amsterdam as director of the Zeeman laboratory.
Nice.
And still later he was during about 4 or 5 years, the director of CERN, of the Nuclear Research Institute in Geneva.
I see.
And then he had an accident, and he was killed in a helicopter accident.
And did Oort ask him also to?
Whether Oort personally invited him, I wouldn't be surprised if it was Oort who thought up And I can almost guess what happened, that Oort Vya, his friends of the Academy of Sciences, tried to find out who would be the best man in the country to do just that, yeah. And found him. Hmm.
And what about the actual giving of the colloquium? Now, I've seen this this picture that was made in the late 50s.
Yeah, that was, of course, Kleibrink, the photographer, who is an extremely experienced movie maker. You couldn't call him an amateur, because usually he's a member of the jury rather than somebody making the films.
Right.
He at that time found it nice to include.
Here, Vanderholtz told me about how Kleibrink assembled together all the people that had been at the original symposium and tried to put them in old clothes so that it looked like wartime conditions. But he joked that they couldn't recreate their waistlines. They were all somewhat more than during the war, when they didn't have much to eat and were younger. And so now flip over to the other side, just about this portion, at this point of the tape, but not exactly, to continue the interview. I'm afraid the first 5 minutes or so of the other side is garbled because the tape was sticking as it went through, but stick with it, you can get the gist of it.